Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Yes, if it's Wednesday, it means we're Zooming on Tuesday, so I just want to remind everyone of that. But of course, we begin our show every single day, and we have for months now, with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. As you know, he was walked out of the White House in February of 2020, and just last week, he retired. In fact, I think he was really forced out because of the horrific treatment that he received after leaving the White House. But if you want to hear the voice of a patriot, if you want to remember what it sounds like, listen to Lieutenant Colonel Vindman and carry that testimony in your head when you go into the election booth or vote by mail in 2020. Now, Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Joining us right now is, I think, one of my favorite talkers. He writes for Slate.com, and he now has a series of podcasts for Slate.com. Henry Graeber writes a lot about the future of city. I was a kid from Brooklyn, so I always had that sort of urban feel and urban pull. So as I took political science and religion, I thought, well, let me do, you know, urban affairs as well. So I've always had this sort of sense of looking at cities and city planning and all this stuff. What you're writing about now, Henry Graeber, is it's both exciting and really depressing. And you have the whole series, and one was entitled, Will COVID Push People Out of Cities for Good? Is COVID flight a thing? And then in a lot of ways, something that's very intimate to cities because they have so many multiple level buildings. The COVID era office will be more collaborative, not less. But of course, I'm trying to imagine who's coming back to the office. So let me welcome Henry Graeber to the program. How are you, Henry?
I'm good. Thanks for having me, Arnie.
It's a pleasure. So let's talk about how people are looking at the city, especially since New York, in a lot of ways, we all lived what was happening in New York City when it was at the worst point with this pandemic. And now we're beginning to see replicas of that happening all over the country. We air in Houston, Texas. Houston, Texas is in a lot of ways the next New York City. And then there's a place in Florida, the next New York City. And of course, instead of learning, they unfortunately did not learn the lesson. But what is so interesting is that not only did New York City go through this horrific pandemic, but it's really flattened the curve and the numbers of people who are dying have dropped down to sort of a, maybe on one hand practically, but it has frightened everyone. So talk to me about who you talked to as you looked at the whole question is, are people really fleeing? Are they fleeing for the moment? Will they come back? And in what way will they come back? Which I think is the other interesting thing. A lot of wealthy people can afford to be in many places. They probably already have four or five homes. But for people who don't have that kind of lifestyle, what does living or fleeing the city mean in a permanent basis?
I don't know. I think it's very hard to figure that out. We know that people have left temporarily. We don't know if they're going to stay away. I think there's been this sense, well, let's go back a minute. For a moment there, it seemed like New York City was the only place this was going to happen. And the question was, how do we get away from this dense city full of subway trains and apartment buildings into some place where we won't be affected by COVID? And that sense of the conversation, I think, has really changed. Now that we have all these outbreaks across the Sun Belt, it's clear that New York City as a city was not the problem. Now, whether the fact that restaurants and bars and other amenities are closed reduces the appeal of city living and offices, that remains to be seen, but I think it's clear now that you are just as vulnerable at an elementary school in the suburbs at a church in the middle of nowhere, at a meatpacking town. You're just as vulnerable as those places, in those places, as you are in a big city.
Except in a big city, by definition, and I think I may have sent you these pictures, or I will tell you the story of these pictures. So at the very beginning, when everybody was terrified about what was happening in New York, my girlfriend took a picture of the subway, and it was coming from the Bronx going into downtown Manhattan. And what really blew her mind, and she took a series of pictures at each stop. And initially, when she got on the train, which she was a little bit nervous about, the train was really packed. And it was a very diverse audience. It was very Hispanic. It was very African-American, a handful of white people. But it was very packed. As it moved closer and closer and closer to Manhattan and the downtown and the more sort of fashionable she area, the train was getting emptier and emptier and emptier. And so by the time she gets to her final stop, there's like three people on the subway. And it really told the story of who had to go to work and who didn't have to go to work, who could work remotely, and also about the sort of wealth-poor gap. And I think that's part of the story of the city, is that even if you can get it anywhere, it's hard not to be in a more dense environment just to get from here to there, because how do you do it without getting on a bus or getting on a subway? And that may not be true in a more sort of rural or less developed area.
I think that's true. That's true. I will say also, though, that despite the obvious inequalities along class lines in cities, transit itself does not seem to have been a major spreader. At least that's what we can deduce from the places where society has opened up again. We look at Japan, we look at China, we look at South Korea, we look at Europe. They're finding that people wearing masks on trains and buses basically makes that not any more dangerous than going to a grocery store. So I think that's wow. Very promising news for cities. But the other question is, if people don't need to come to cities, I think this is sort of the conclusion I came to when I thought this through on my on this podcast we did about people leaving cities. People leave cities every year. Tens of thousands of people leave every city every year. It's just that new people arrive to take their place. And those new people are pulled in by new jobs. They're pulled in by starting school. They're pulled in by other connections. And I think what we're going to see this year is that a lot of people left. A lot of those people would have left already. They've gone to stay with family or what have you. But they're not being replaced. And there's nobody coming down the chain. And until offices open back up, until classrooms open back up, there is little reason for new people to move into those apartments. And I do think that is going to put a drain on some of these places. The other thing I would say is that there's been this, I think, narrative that people are leaving cities because they can't go out to eat at the restaurant, they can't go to a Broadway show. And that may be true at a very superficial level, but I think there's a much deeper connection that most urbanites have to cities. They don't stick around because of the amenities. They stick around because that's where their friends are, that's where their family is, that's where their apartment is. So I think people's ties to the places they live are quite a bit deeper than just the bar on the corner. And I think it's going to take a little bit more than 6 months of a pandemic to send people fleeing into rural America.
Except, Henry, let me just make a couple of thoughts. A couple of things running through my head. One is that what we're beginning to hear is that this pandemic may not be a one-off. That in fact, we may be seeing future pandemics, that in part climate change has exposed us to maybe more things, that there are these other potential illnesses or whatever. And so part of you is thinking, okay, if this is one every 100 years, I can handle it. I'll go away for a year and a half and I'll come back, or I'll live it out for a year and a half and I'll come back. But we're beginning to hear some of the scientists say that this may not be one, it may be a beginning of a pattern. So we need to rethink. Two, we've also had an experience now with a lot of people working very effectively remotely. That's not true of a lot of people who must show up for work, but there are people, especially in those high rises, in the architectural firms, in some of the business firms, whatever, who are able to actually function at a pretty high level and they don't have to come into work. That's going to have a huge impact on the value of commercial real estate. That's going to have a huge impact on the people that serve those people that work in those commercial buildings, that are serving, Thai food or whatever. And that's the other thing is that, are they going to want to come back?
Right. So there's two questions there. I am less concerned about future pandemics. I think it's important to remember the reason we're even having this conversation right now is because we live under a deeply corrupt and incompetent administration with no precedent, right? Like, it did not have to be this way. And if you look at other countries that were also kind of blindsided, places like Italy and France, they have now recovered. Life is going on as it did before, and we could be there, you know? We could be there. So that's part one. Let's not forget the context which we're having this conversation. That said, now that we're living here with the idiot president and the crazy governors who didn't think that it would happen there, we have to confront the fact that we're facing this improbable future. And I do think that, number one, people are finding success working remotely. And the other more worrisome thing maybe is that the infrastructure of a city is just not meant to, you can't just pause everything for 6 months. You know what I mean? Like, I think a lot of these restaurants and comedy clubs and theaters and all this stuff, they're going to start to close. They're starting to close already. And that is not only sad, but it also just is going to really take something away from the appeal of urban life and the vibrancy of the places that amount to our civilization.
Okay, so let me answer my question, because you said we have a bad administration. Amen. Okay, I totally agree with you. I mean, I wish we could be better off, and I wish we could be South Korea, but unfortunately we're not. Maybe the next administration can be kind of a version of South Korea. I'm not quite so sure. I think there's also an American mindset that's kind of unfortunate here. And I think that, you know, Donald Trump just fed into it. But I live in a state, Henry, which was chosen by a group called the Free State Project. Ever hear of them? The Free State Project are a bunch of libertarians that want to basically come into the state and then dismantle government, okay? And they're the no maskers, no social distancing, screw you. I mean, they're just, and they've all decided to pick New Hampshire as a state that's going to be their great experiment. Well, we're seeing that there's 33% of Americans who are following Donald Trump off the cliff. And I don't know whether they disappear when Donald Trump leaves office, assuming he loses in November. But there is this sort of interesting me, myself, and I kind of selfish mode that you don't see in a lot of Europe. Europe has a very different sort of attitude. But let's say we can improve. My question is there a commitment we have to that kind of culture, whether it's comedy bars or whether it's Broadway and musicals and opera and whatever, that we can literally just pay them to hermetically seal for a year. Not like regular businesses, because they're not really like regular. We're not asking them to sort of ooze back in. We want them to shut, okay? And then when everything is good, they can then open, but they can't do the 25%, the 50%. That's garbage. It just doesn't work.
Well, yeah, I mean, what you're describing is what we should have done from the start, right?
Yes.
But we didn't do it. And now we really do have to make some difficult choices, right? Like, are we just going to let the pandemic rage until there's a vaccine? Or are we going to keep these sort of piecemeal shutdowns going? I think one thing that's been demonstrated is currently happening in the Midwest is even if you have successfully controlled the spread of COVID-19, if you have a state 800 miles away but connected by frequent flights, whatever, that hasn't, it's going to come back. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you can only do so much on a local level to keep things down. I do feel optimistic about the American people, because I think that even if the nut job to normal ratio is, you know, let's say 20% nut job, which seems high, right? I think it's lower than that. But even if that's what it was, I think that would be fine, because you don't actually need everyone to wear masks. You just need a sizable majority of people to wear masks to stop the sort of rapid transmission. So it's not rocket science, right? Like, yes, there's Darwin too. Let's not put the Europeans or the Japanese on a pedestal. They're not any more invested in their fellow countrymen, I think, than we are. At least I don't want to think they are, and I don't think they are. We could have done this. It's not rocket science.
Yeah, but let me just say something though. So I said we should have done this in the beginning, but I'm not talking about hermetically sealing everyone. There are certain things that are just so, to me, you know, I'm looking at all the operas and I'm you know, the big theaters in every community. Every community has a big theater for the most part. Every community has a theater group. It's almost like there's like this cultural aspect that just can't survive right now. but they can't die off. You know, I go back to the Great Depression. And during the Great Depression, I mean, they literally paid photographers to run around the country and take photographs. They paid people to make music. They paid people. They understood that there was a necessity to maintain the cultural underpinnings of society, even if nobody had any frickin' money. And you look at that model, and I'm saying we need something like that now. Because we're not, this isn't just about, you know, what the food on your table, and this isn't just about, you know, the sort of the basics. This is about sort of the cultural Velcro that holds a nation together. I want them to survive. And yet you have to put them in a separate silo because they're not like the rest of us. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And, you know, our next episode of this podcast is about municipal finance, which sounds like a boring topic. But let's just say it's not just the restaurants and bars that are going to go out of business, right? We're already seeing enormous layoffs among local government employees, libraries closing, counties have laid off, I think, 1.2 million people already, local governments in general have, so that's counties and cities. And we saw what happened with that after the Great Recession. As these places cut their budgets, they begin to cut corners, defer maintenance. You know, down that road lies situations like Flint, Michigan, where you had a city that where local democracy was subverted because they were broke and they got this emergency manager from the state who made the decision to take in water from the Flint River, which we all know how that story ends, but how it begins is with a cash-strapped local government. I think that people, veterans of the Obama administration, will acknowledge that one of the big failures of the response to the Great Recession was that they did not do enough to support state and local governments. And I think that that is clearly something that needs to happen going forward. So it's not just about culture creators. It's also about the basic infrastructure of society,
like
bus routes, parks, libraries, this stuff. And I guess what gives me hope is that the situation is so daunting that unless the Biden administration, knock on wood, does something really, really ambitious, they're going to be in a position no better than Trump. I mean, this is not going to solve itself at this point through good management. We need money.
Well, you know, it's interesting. And you can use in an interesting way, the whole big conversation now is about reopening schools. And what we're finding out is that education isn't just about education. It actually is about the entire economy. Because it's not educating little five-year-olds to become, you know, I don't know, CEOs or working at a car parts store or whatever. It turns out that education is important because in order for a lot of people to participate in the economy, their kids have to be in school. Because once you're talking about not being in school, you're talking about homeschooling. Once you're talking about homeschooling, we're not talking just about the little tutties that are 5, 6, 7, and 8. We're talking about kids probably up till 12th grade because somebody has to make sure that they're really going to school, assuming that they're able to do it technologically. And it has just huge ramifications, you know, across the entire economy. We always said how we valued education. Oh my God. Now we're realizing what a ripple effect it has on absolutely every aspect of the economy.
Yeah, I keep hearing these teachers on NPR, and it drives me crazy when they're asked, what's your plan for reopening? The plan for reopening, and this goes for schools, and it goes for barbecue joints, and it goes for everything else. The plan for reopening is to get the virus under control.
Yes.
You know what I mean? There's no cheating here. There's no hack. You can't design a classroom to be COVID-proof at a time when the state of Florida is recording 15,000 new cases in a day. It's just not going to work. So I think smart people have known this from the beginning, but the pandemic is the economy and the economy is the pandemic. You cannot figure out the economy without figuring out the pandemic.
How do we get teachers and how do we get principals and superintendents to say exactly what you just said? They're looking at schools to figure it out. And you just pointed out schools can't figure it out if the COVID is going wild. Schools can't figure it out if there isn't a mandatory mask requirement. Schools can't figure out. You can't put schools and say figure it out when everything around them is falling apart because that means it falls apart right in your school. They can't separate it out, you know, and that is, I think, what is so ridiculous as if, you know, Donald Trump can say open schools and if you don't open schools, we're going to not give you money. Well, no, Donald Trump have a mandatory mask requirement across the entire United States, and then everything else falls into place. But you almost see this chorus coming out of schools saying, when you figure out how to control the pandemic, call us because we can't fix it in isolation.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what they should say. They should listen to your show, and then they should go back on All Things Considered and say, you know what I mean? I teach seventh grade science. It's not my job. It's not my job to halt the COVID-19 pandemic.
Can I just say, I think that there are teachers who are saying that. There are teachers individually and as unions who are, I don't know if they're going on strike yet, but they're certainly making it clear to the administration that their health is worth something too. And people talk about, well, are the kids going to be a burden to their parents staying home and not having daycare? Or are we going to send them to school where the teachers can be their daycare, but the teachers have lives too and health too? And I think that is starting to be raised. But you're right, yes, the politicians are not listening to them.
You're right. I, what it gets down to is that it goes beyond, you know, the future of cities or whatever, which is my pet subject. But what we're really dealing with is we're living under an astonishing failure of state capacity. And it's hard to recognize because it's not accompanied by like burning buildings and martial law and people stealing things from each other on the street, right? It's just this slow realization that we have completely failed. And that is going to ripple through every institution, from the office to transit, to schools, to parks, to libraries, to municipal budgets. It's all going down, you know, the whole ship is going down, really. So it's a very strange experience for me, and I'm sure for your listeners too. I don't think any of us have lived through a period where we feel like the government is so incompetent to look after our safety, and it's weird.
So Henry, my daughter lives in China. And so I've been living through this, like, this is like pandemic two for me, because I lived through pandemic one with her, okay? So she was months ahead of us. And I remember writing in March on my Facebook page how we have to have a mandatory mask requirement. And everybody thought I was like coming from La La Land. And I said, no. Let me tell you what I'm hearing they're doing in China. And I understand it's an authoritarian country and everybody's afraid of the government. But let me tell you, the pandemic doesn't notice what kind of government you have. They don't care whether it's democratically elected. They don't care whether it's a king. They don't care whether it's Xi, all right? And I said, because the things that they are doing are things that address a pandemic, not based on their authoritarian. I mean, they may be able to mandate it easier and there's not a lot of blowback, but what they're doing is about control. And I got such a raft of, you can't even imagine, Henry. And now I sit there going, okay, I don't want to be cocky and right, but I'm going to be cocky and right. And this is so unfortunate because you're absolutely right. We were incredibly failed by our government. And let me just end by one more thing, because school is the big shtick right now. How do we reopen schools? Let me remind you, schools have been the dumping ground for all of society's problems. You haven't fed kids? Okay, we'll feed you at school. You haven't send them to a doctor? Okay, we'll make sure that the nurse checks them. You don't deal with them with the mental health? Okay, we'll have someone deal with them in the mental health and give them a special needs teacher. You haven't, I mean, think about it. Schools have become the dumping ground for everything we failed to do. And now we're looking at schools to somehow come back during the middle of a pandemic that we haven't addressed, as if they can find an answer, when all they are right now are a reflection of our failure. And that's so unfair. And I think it's an opportunity now for schools to speak out, not only about the pandemic, but understand that they can't keep feeding everyone. They can't make sure that everyone stays healthy. They can't clothe them. They can't give them soap so they can take a shower. They can't make sure that they have some sort of internet access when they don't. And yet this is an opportunity to actually look at schools in a very different way, because the pandemic has shown how crucial they are, but they can't operate in isolation.
I couldn't agree more.
I love you. Henry Graybar writes for Slate.com. His focus is on cities, and he now has a new podcast. What's your podcast called, Mr. Graybar? My competition?
It's called What Next TBD.
What Next TBD? I want everyone to check it out. Henry, you still better show up with me. That's all I have to say.
I will.
All right. Henry Graybar, Slate.com. Join us again. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. We're going to a break.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1959. That was the day 500,000 steelworkers walked off the job in a historic 116-day strike in defense of work rules. It was the largest industry-wide strike. It was also the last. The strike affected 12 steel companies and shut down more than 85% of steel production. Mill owners refused to grant wage increases unless the union agreed to changes in the contract. Specifically, they were looking to eliminate Section 2B, titled Local Working Conditions. The bosses wanted the ability to change the number of workers assigned to any given task. They also wanted to introduce new machinery and rules that would reduce labor hours and cut the workforce. United Steelworker members understood this as an assault on workplace safety and a move to break the union. Mill bosses hoped that a long strike would provoke the membership to abandon their union. But according to Jack Metzger, author of Striking Steel, members had grown used to walkouts every 3 years and planned accordingly. As well, the United Steelworkers had a well-oiled machinery, including an internal welfare system for hardship cases, and also reached out to merchants, banks, charitable agencies, and local and state governments to organize relief. By the end of August, the Department of Defense stoked anxieties that national security was at risk. 3 months into the strike, union funds dwindled and strikers felt the pinch. President Eisenhower invoked a Taft-Hartley injunction, hoping to force strikers back to work. As the union rose to challenge Taft-Hartley's constitutionality, solidarity among the mill owners crumbled. Kaiser Steel broke ranks and settled separately. Their contract granted wage increases and preserved Section 2B, which set the precedent for the contract that was eventually signed industry-wide.
Welcome back to part two of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. So let me explain to you why I reached out to Pogo. So we have a guy on every other week, and his name is Bill Curry. Bill Curry is one of the smartest progressive talkers I know. He used to work in the Clinton administration. He ran for the governor of Connecticut. He's written for lots of places, including Salon.com and a number of other things. And we were talking about defunding the police. And he said, no, that's not the answer. What we need to do is talk about demilitarize the police. And I went, he's right. Because I've noticed this incredible change in how my officers of the peace even dress, let alone the kind of equipment they have. And I live in Little New Hampshire. So as I was thinking about his comment, I found an article at Pogo entitled Poisoning Our Police, How the Militarization Mindset Threatens Constitutional Rights and Public Safety. Let me welcome to the program the two co-authors of that absolutely fabulous piece that you could just mine for information for days. Wayne, is it McElrath? Is that pronounced correctly, Wayne?
That is correct.
is a senior investigative advisor to POGO. He is also the president and CEO of XGE Consulting, and a government, private sector, and nonprofit consultant, and an international speaker for over 25 years. He is the former director of forensic investigations with the Government Accountability Office, and his resume just goes on and on and on. And joining us as well is his co-author. And Sarah, can you share with our audience a little bit about your background? Because it was much more pithy at POGO as to what it is that you do. And I want to make sure that Sarah Tuberville has more than just the director position at POGO, but that they get a little bit more about you.
Sure. So I'm a lawyer by training. And my role as head of the Constitution Project at POGO is to oversee all of the work that we do around protection of constitutional rights, particularly when they are threatened by our government's domestic security and national policing, or national security and domestic policing powers. And of course, militarization of police is an interesting intersection of both of those things. I also had a role in helping to create a report that we produced back in 2016 on this very topic that came out on the heels of what was at that time the latest conversation around police reform coming out of the protests in Ferguson and the killing of Michael Brown and the police's response to that. And we pulled together a commission or a task force of former military officials, former law enforcement officials, and some civil rights and civil liberties experts to really take a deep dive into this issue of militarization. And
So what does POGO stand for?
We are the Project on Government Oversight.
Okay. All right. So Wayne, this is just, it just oozes information. And once you almost want to read it out loud because you want people to hear it, because as they hear it, you understand what has morphed within the police really since 1990. And one of the things, one of the sentences at the very beginning that just sort of jumped out at me, and I want to read it back to you, and then we can take that from there. As police officers drape themselves in the trappings of a military force, they increasingly look like members of an army prepared to go to war against unarmed civilians, escalating tensions between the police and peaceful protesters. As a 2017 study showed us, in law enforcement agencies that use military equipment, officers are more likely to display violent behavior and are more likely to kill the civilians they're supposed to protect and serve. So Wayne, what we have been doing is that we've been dressing them up as if they were soldiers. And when you dress up as Cinderella, or you dress up as a fireman, or you dress up as a soldier, you actually start acting like that. We kind of see that during Halloween, but imagine if you wear it all the time, Wayne, and then you're given more equipment to go along with your dress, and then you're given, you know, bear cats, and you're given all these other things. When did this happen? And who wanted to turn the police into a military force, Wayne?
I think this has been a very slow-moving evolution that started after 9/11. And with the implementation of the 1997 NDAA and those giving the police access to this type of equipment and the heightened sense of security that the nation was going through, it began to bleed into our psyche, into our media, into the way that we do things. Sarah and I, back when we started working on this particular article together, and the line that you read, I wish I could take full credit for it, but Sarah put a lot into that.
It's a fabulous line. Let me just tell you, keep going.
It is. We looked at issues like the Yale study, where we had individuals within a college institution back in, I believe, the 70s, who were, you know, they dressed up as, it was a study that was actually done where the researcher had a certain portion of the students act as guards and another subset act as prisoners. Right. And that interaction, and that was helped fuel that conversation on how does, you know, the trappings change the culture. Yes. And we go through this out throughout the course of our lives. We are, you know, we play at these games and we do these things that help us develop who we are as a culture. And I think that's happened within the police department and also what's even more tragic is that it's happening to the citizenry that they're supposed to protect by indoctrinating us into that culture also, where now a MRAP or military uniforms or fully automatic weapons being carried by police don't seem abnormal.
No. And yet, so Sarah, a couple of years ago, I do a radio show on a very conservative station. I've been doing it every Friday morning for 20 years. They think I'm on every day, but I'm only on for like 15 or 20 minutes once a week. But that's okay. You know, it's appointment radio. Arnie's on, the liberal. But I remember when they were being given a Bearcat,
mm-hmm.
okay? And there was a big fight within the community. We don't need that, you know, that tank. You know, yes, we do need, and this is a little tiny, it's a beautiful little rural kind of college town, Keene, New Hampshire, not far from the Connecticut River. I mean, I'm thinking, who are they gonna use a Bearcat with, you know? And it was a big, and that was just the beginning, and things calmed down. They accepted the Bearcat, and now people defend it. Oh, there were these two kids that were lost in the woods, and we used the Bearcat to grab them. And I'm thinking, really, you couldn't have used a Jeep? You know what I mean?
Right.
And it was there that I started beginning to realize, oh my God, why would anybody offer little Keen a Bearcat? What the hell is this about? And then, of course, let's fast forward to what we saw happening in just the last couple of weeks, whether it was in Washington, D.C., or whether it was in Minneapolis. And what you saw was nothing that looked like a cop. I mean, I felt like I was in Baghdad in Iraq, right? And that's what it felt like. But if that's what it feels like, then they are looking at me differently, and I am looking at them differently, Sarah.
And I think that's where the constitutional concerns come in.
Yes.
Right? Because if you've got that kind of show of force coupled with whatever tactics they're using on top of this equipment, it has a very intimidating effect on people that are, you know, merely exercising their constitutional rights. Rights, by the way, that the police are there to protect. You know, well, that's been one of our concerns for a number of years, is the impact that this has on protesters and citizens' willingness to actually exercise their First Amendment rights.
Oops.
As I'm thinking about this, Wayne, I don't know if you wrote this paragraph, but what happened to George Floyd didn't involve equipment. It didn't involve people that looked like they were, you know, basically coming out of the military. It was just a cop. It was a cop putting his knee on someone's neck, you know, for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. You know what amazes me, Wayne? 8 minutes and 46 seconds will be remembered forever, mm-hmm. forever, because of what happened to George Floyd. Mm-hmm. But explain that, where they weren't in a military setting, but yet what they did felt so not human. It felt, in a way, like somehow this wasn't somebody who had like passed a bad bill. It was someone who was perceived as somehow the enemy. And he wasn't an enemy. He was someone that lived in Minneapolis.
Right. I mean, and unfortunately, we see this all the time, especially when it comes to the policing of Black and brown communities or around the world, where military force is being used in abundance by our government, where after a while, after operating in an environment in a militaristic attitude, the other become less than human.
Yes.
Justifying the excessive use of force, which is something that as a free society, we should rail against, not only at home, but abroad also.
So you said that this has been going on for a while. So it's been sort of evolving. And, you know, first, and I think it went back, Sarah, am I right, to the 1990s, not even 9/11, that there was an opportunity for them to start dumping maybe excess military equipment, like what's it called, 1033 or something like that, that mm-hmm. we've been able to sort of, we've started to see this shift of material. You know, I'm an environmentalist. I like the idea of reuse and recycle, but I'm not quite sure this was the kind of reuse and recycle I've been thinking about when I'm thinking about, so what do you do with excess military equipment? Well, of course you give it to the cops. Whose idea was that in the 1990s? I'm just so appalled. Or was that really the precursor to what unfortunately defined Bill Clinton and to some extent even Joe Biden, which was the criminal reform bill, where all of a sudden we're going to get tough on crime. And not only did we get tough on crime, but we expanded our prisons, but also we then also started seeing a change in how we viewed how cops should deal with crime.
Well, that's right, that to some degree, it certainly predates 9/11 and goes back to the war on drugs and the proliferation of a lot of, you know, sort of state, local, federal joint task force operations and those kinds of things. You know, I think what up until about 2014, what was most concerning about this equipment was how it showed up through the use of SWAT teams. Right. And so not only did you have the creation of the 1033 program through the Department of Defense, which is and Wayne can speak to this much better than I can, as he sort of did an undercover operation about all of the problems with the program. But, you know, not only is that program shifting a lot of this excess material, but there is this there's this explosion in the use of SWAT teams across the country. You know, where we go from having zero to having 14,000. And, you know, you really wonder in a place like Keene, New Hampshire, why in the hell you would need a SWAT team, right? And it's a problem, as Wayne described, that, you know, has just evolved into this extraordinary thing with the capacity for such incredible abuse. Now that this equipment is in the hands of so many people that are often not trained to use it,
right,
in agencies that don't need it, in communities that don't want it, through a program that keeps no tabs on it almost at all.
So Wayne, let's talk to that, because Sarah, you did mention it, and I did see that part where they, well, I'm so glad you went undercover. I wish I was going with you, because, you know, the fact is that who requests it? I don't know. What they're going to use it for, I don't know. So tell me what your undercover work discovered about this military equipment that suddenly is found across the country in many, many places, big towns, little towns, towns the size of 600 to big cities. But you also found out that you could make up a city and get equipment. Oy vey. I mean, you don't even have to be real. And if you made it up, Wayne, imagine if other people were making it up or making up the need for what they're getting. And that is what's so terrifying. You know, it's one thing to have, you know, this stuff flowing into communities. It's another thing to not know where it's going and what it's being used for.
Now, our original look at the 1033 program occurred during two time periods. I think it was 2006, we looked at the program, and then again in 2016, 2017. During our 2016 and 17 look, we actually didn't test the state program. We didn't test the state coordinators, but what we did was we basically invented a federal organization, a federal law enforcement organization. We totally fabricated a statute of law that this organization had authority under. And then we fabricated an organizational structure as well as our equipment needs. And we submitted a justification that wasn't supported by anything, that we completely just made up, and were able to gain access, not only access to the program, but to receive equipment to the tune of over $1 million. Being the Government Accountability Office, we didn't want to embarrass the Department of Defense and the DLA. We didn't go after what's known as controlled items. You have non-controlled items, which are like computers, typewriters, office equipment. And then you have those controlled items, which are firearms, MRAPs, bayonets or whatever. We could have gone after all of those different types of equipment. We just chose to keep our footprint in this particular look very small. But we could have gotten anything and that we wanted, and the justification was just what we said it was. So just imagine if you have a police department who's not communicating with the community at all, and the chief decides he wants to, you know what, I want to step up this game, and I'm going to get all this military grade equipment. He basically just needs to submit a justification to the DLA. And we talk about the cost. Well, yeah, you're getting the equipment for free, but now once you have that equipment, how much does it cost as far as passive costs? How much is it costing for those communities to maintain those that equipment, for you to train on that equipment, and with little to no oversight at all? It's
frightening.
Yeah, people don't think about how much this is really costing. They look at the initial outlay of this. It's free, but those are police officers that can be patrolling your streets that are out training with this equipment that they may never use.
Well, it's not only that, but so I'm going to go back to that Yale study that you talked about at the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to give you another kind of variation on that theme. And I've used this over and over again, because I'm thinking about these guys carrying this equipment that they have and not either necessarily knowing how to use it, or what are they using it for, or maybe never using it, but they have access to it. And the community doesn't even know they have it. And you also talk about the maintenance. So there's all these ripple effects from what happens once you get this equipment into the hands of police within local communities and cities and towns. So here's what I know. There was a study done, and it was looking at the fact that we had this proliferation of guns in America. That's the other problem. Let's take the cops' side. The cops know that there are more guns in America than there are human beings. Okay, there's just and in fact, I've been looking at the number of purchases in the last like 2 or 3 months. It's gone through the roof. I mean, they can't supply the bullets. They can't supply the guns. So they're obviously ready to kill the pandemic. They're going to kill COVID-19. I hate to break it to them, but a gun won't do it. But maybe that's what they're thinking. But one of the things that we've learned is when you are weaponized, and I don't mean a cop, but when you carry a gun and you see someone around you, let's say you're having a fight, you're having an angry something on the street, you don't know this person, and this person reaches into their pocketbook or reaches into their pocket, because you are weaponized, you're assuming they are too. So that you move into a weapon mode instead of a conversational mode. My fear with what's happened with the police, with all this militarization, is that they don't see themselves as cops anymore. They don't see themselves as community servants anymore. They don't see themselves as officers of the peace anymore. They see themselves as looking at people on the street as the enemy and not really people that they're to serve. Because when they're weaponized the way they are, that's not what someone in the community sort of creates a relationship with. You don't create a relationship with the kind of equipment they're carrying, Wayne.
No, not at all. The thing is that when there's no reason to de-escalate, when you think that you have, you know, more firepower, or that you can easily overcome them with force.
Exactly.
As opposed to negotiating, de-escalating. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I can just use sheer force to be able, my appearance, everything speaks to my inherent authority and the force that I can, you know, bring to the situation to get you to comply, as opposed to, let's talk.
Oh, Sarah, so I'm a mother. And I also used to hang out with campers, and I used to be camp director and whatever. And I remember I used to have this one kid who, whenever they got frustrated, they would start hitting. So one of the things I would say is, no, use words. No, use words. Not fists, use words. Well, I feel like in a lot of ways, this is a conversation about demilitarization of the police. No, you don't need that piece of equipment. Use your head. Right. Use words. Don't be violent. Try to do the alternative. And what we've done is, what I'm reading from both you and Wayne, is that since 1990, and now it seems to ramp up, we have actually walked away from the more social worker, community-oriented cop to someone that looks more like someone who would be on the streets of Baghdad in Iraq. So you not only did this report, but then you made recommendations. So I said, not defund the police, Sarah. I said, demilitarize the police. So tell me a couple of the recommendations that you made after bringing together all these remarkable people to look at what has happened over the last 20 or 30 years and what they've seen ramp up. How do we de-ramp?
Well, I think what you're pointing to, Arnie, is this shift in our policing from a guardian mindset to a warrior mindset.
Yes.
And this was the primary sort of theme and concern that came out of this enormous project that the Obama administration undertook, called the Task Force on 21st Century Policing. And I believe this was its first recommendation, and it was our task force's recommendation. And that's that the more important than the equipment is training and culture that creates a guardian mindset among local police, so that they see their community members as people that they have to protect and serve, not as the enemy. Because the great irony of the, like, all of this is that it not only makes us like less free from the perspective of, you know, if you're out protesting, but, you know, this militarization mindset also makes us less safe.
Yes.
Because it makes community members a lot more, as you described, resistant to cooperating with police. And to prevent crime and solve crime, you need cooperation of the community.
Well, you know, it's interesting. So as I'm listening to you, so I'm going to go just quickly back to Wayne. So one of the things I've learned, so Houston has about 600,000 undocumented immigrants. And yet when there is a hurricane, everybody gets hurt. When there's a pandemic, everyone gets hurt. You know, the hurricane doesn't say, are you a citizen or you're not a citizen? Are you documented or are you undocumented? So in order to protect your city, you don't want to drive people into the shadows. You still need a level of trust, because we are still in community, no matter who it is. And what I see happening with this militarization, it's not only what is so incredibly threatening to Black and brown people, which is clearly the case, but I think it has a negative impact across the entire community. And it's not building on trust, it's eroding trust, Wayne. So as I'm hearing Sarah talk about, you know, it's one thing to have this equipment, but it's another thing to have the different kind of guardian mindset. How do you have a guardian mindset, Wayne, when you're giving them that piece of equipment? I mean, I hate to break it to you, but it seems like, you know, they're mutually exclusive. You can't have a guardian mindset and then give them a piece of military equipment and assume that that's going to somehow make you a social worker.
No, it's not going to make you a social worker. But at the same time, in certain isolated incidents, there might be a need for that type of equipment to be within your reach or within your grasp. But in the grand scheme of things, we should be looking at ways to build those bridges between police and communities so that they can better serve, and as you indicated, not drive people into the shadows, so that they can receive the type of information that they need to be able to solve problems and to make fixes in the immediate. Police aren't social workers, but they are the first step in the criminal justice process, and then also our ability to be able to stop something from happening that shouldn't in the immediate.
Yeah.
And when we look at the whole defunding the police issue, it's not that no one really wants to get rid of the police. We want to shift priorities. And I think these types of conversations help us begin to relook at how those priorities should be shifted to keep individuals in the light, as opposed to being a part of an amorphous group that we don't really think about. And if you look at situations where the police would need that type of equipment, we have the National Guard.
Yes, exactly. Oh my God. So Sarah,
who has access to all of that equipment?
Exactly. So, geez. Anyways, so Sarah, one of the things I saw that you had in your recommendations was this idea of transparency. So one of the things I would hope is that every city council would go to their police department and say, so what equipment do you have? I'm just kind of curious. What do we have? I don't think they even freaking know. All right? Because as Wayne mentioned before, you just write out the list. I want this, I want that, I want this, I want that. And they ship it. Now, my understanding is, Wayne, since it doesn't cost anything, they don't have to make it a request form because they're not asking for money. But they're, they're, you know, and so I just think it would be a wonderful opportunity for every city and town in America to go to their police department, not as a threat, but as an open, transparent conversation. So what is it that we have in the way of equipment? You know, I just want to know. And I think that is the beginning of the conversation about, okay, so how are you trained on this? Why do we need this? Mm-hmm. How often have we used this? Mm-hmm. And in a way, that I think is the beginning of understanding that you don't want to say to the police, I want to take something away from you. I just need to understand why it is you have what you have. And maybe we need to have a conversation because we are in community together. You know, you're working for us and vice versa. We're working with you. And I think that's a little bit less threatening, but it's the beginning of a conversation that we have to have.
Right. And that ultimately there's some materials in this program that communities don't ever need, that just need to be on a prohibited list. But before a community gets any of this kind of material and armament, the federal government ought to be assured that the that is actually what the community wants. And that ought to be a criteria before this stuff is shipped out.
Exactly. And I think this conversation we're having now, Wayne, is important because if you hear this conversation about it, if you dress like this and you act like this, then guess what? You become more of that military mindset instead of the officer of the peace. Then what you're saying is, I'm gonna take some of this burden away from you. I don't want you to wear this costume because you begin to act like this costume. And, you know, and it's I know I sound crazy, but in a lot of ways, what do they say in architecture? That function follows form. Well, in a lot of ways, the form you're giving them is the form of a soldier, not the form of a police person. And I think that's really, really unfortunate. Yeah.
I was just going to say on that note, we're running out of time.
Thank you.
But I did want to ask these two wonderful investigators if for their next project, they might want to look into the new ICE pilot program of training
citizens
to be vigilante paramilitary ICE enforcers. And, you know, it's a scary thought, but Pogo is up to the task.
Oh, Sarah and Wayne, this is an incredible report. It should be given to every single city council in America and every town in America. They need to read it. It's sobering, it's frightening, and yet at the same time, we've kind of set cops up to fail. Because by handing them this equipment, we ultimately didn't really protect them or help them. And I think if we want to be fair here, we need to understand that the burden is placed on both of us. I want them to succeed because their success means my community is safer. I want my community to trust my cops. And that's my goal. So Wayne and Sarah, I'm so glad that Pogo exists, and I want to make sure that everyone reaches out to you and not only grabs this report, Police, How the Militarization Mindset Threatens Constitutional Rights and Public Safety, but take it seriously. And if they address some of the things and recommendations you've suggested in this article, we will be a better country for it. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. We will schmooze tomorrow. Ciao.